Good morning, KRFY listeners. This is your morning show host, Julie Calamine, and I have a special treat for us this morning. This morning, I'm being joined by area disc golf developer, owner of Caliber Disc Golf, Paul Stiller. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Julie. Thank you so much for having me in.
Oh, I'm happy to meet you. Happy to see you. So, Paul, I'd like to start by asking you to tell us about yourself and how you came to be living here in the Sandpoint area and how you got involved in disc golf.
Well, I guess I took a journey when I was 22 years old, as my dad said. I was born and raised in Akron, Ohio. I started playing disc golf in 1986 at the University of Cincinnati and decided to move to Alaska when it was 1991. And, you know, I played disc golf off and on over the years. Back in the 80s, the disc selection was kind of meager. And so I played off and on and got distracted in Alaska and did a lot of things. Rick Leader had a course up there in Haines where we would throw and hit kegs that he developed in a gravel pit and kind of got me going back into disc golf. And then I moved out of Alaska in late 2004 down to Oregon. Mainly played ball golf down there because that's my first love of golf. And then my wife and family and I moved here in 2013. And Rick Leader got me back into playing disc golf because he had built and organized people to help him build the course over at the Vandal Experimental Tree Farm.
Okay.
Over on Boyer.
And did it have a name then, that course?
I think it was just referred to as the Vandal course.
Okay, very good. Well, it's interesting because you're already using terminology that I'm not familiar with. Disc golf, I understand, but then you use the term ball golf, and I think of the sport as frisbee golf, and so there's so many terminologies. What should we be calling it? Disc golf?
I like to call it either disc golf or disc.
Okay.
Because when, you know, I'm kind of a purist golfer, so if I speak of golf, I'm talking about ball golf. If I say disc, that means disc golf.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, what is the history of disc golf? How did it start?
Well, back in the 60s, late 60s, there was Ed Hedrick. In 1966, he was working with Wham-O, and he developed the Frisbee, the first patent on the Frisbee. And coined the term and the concept of disc golf. So frisbees, you know, these were more of a deeper dish frisbee that is used in ultimate. They're a little slower flying. And the original game, you would just throw at trees or you throw at pieces of metal that would tones that would make noise, or you could throw at a keg, or you could make any sort of target out in the woods or a park. So that was 1966. And then Ed Hedrick also, along with his son, in 1977, invented the first basket to catch the disc. It's a piece of metal, kind of like an umbrella, and it has chains that hang down and collect at the bottom. And the disc hits the chains and falls into the basket, and that's when you end your scoring for that hole.
Yes, I've seen them. I have a neighbor up my street who's got one, and I've played a few times with disc golf. It's pretty exciting when you hit the when you actually hit a frisbee, a disc, into
basket. Has a nice ching to it.
Yes, it's pretty neat. So I guess what I need to know a little bit more about is how today, we've heard a bit about the history, but how is it played today? Is it played exactly like doing a ball golf course?
It is. There's 18 holes in disc golf. You start on a tee pad or a tee box, as they're referred to. They can be constructed out of just grass or dirt, concrete. My course has AstroTurf because it's easy on your knees and ankles. There are fairways or areas referred to fairways. They don't necessarily have to be grass. They could just be more of a pathway in the woods. And then there's a target, a pin, and you'd call the area around that the green. You refer to the green as the immediate green as circle one, which is 30 feet within the basket. So that's the true green area in disc golf. So you score it just like golf. For every time you throw it, that is one stroke.
Okay. Well, that's a new term that I didn't know, and I've played Frisbee golf a number of times and didn't know when I was within circle one, and I didn't know that that was similar to being on the green for ball golf. Interesting. So Frisbee golf, disc golf, I think it's like some other sports where you can play it at so many levels. You can take it seriously. You begin, you know, you can reach a certain level of expertise pretty quickly, but then it gets hard. Talk to us a little bit about that progression.
I think that's one of the beauties of disc golf is you can take it as seriously as you want, or you can just back off and do it recreationally. There's a lot of people who play a speed round, which you only have maybe one or two discs, and you literally run through the course and throw. It keeps you loose. You can do it for exercise, endurance, or you can slow down and take it very seriously. The top-level pros in this day and age can take almost a painstaking long time to play a round, upwards of 4 hours, and you're waiting and waiting, but the more serious you take it and the more money that's on the line at the higher levels, you end up developing what's called a pre-shot routine. And you're going to go over your pre-shot routine maybe once or twice before you throw, and you take it very seriously every shot so that you don't just do something you don't mean to do.
Right. And so there is a professional level of disc golf. Talk about that.
Yes. So there's a lot of great disc golfers out there who've been up and coming for the past several decades. Right now, it's being played at a very high level by people like Paul McBeth, Simon Lazat, Chris Clemens, Scott Stokely. On the women's side, we have Paige Pierce. And then down out of Spokane, we have one of my favorite women players, Sai Ananda, who's an up-and-coming pro. And so both on the men's and women's side, they play to a very high level. The tour right now is called the Disc Golf Pro Tour, although there are a lot of other high competition events throughout the country.
Yeah, but there's a pro tour. That's so interesting.
Yes.
Let's go back to the discs for a moment, because with ball golf, we all know you've got your irons and your woods and your putters and all this sort of thing. And in my little disc golf bag, I have three sad looking, they're not sad looking, but I have a total of three discs. And that's not what the pros would have.
Quite possibly. Some of the discs are meant to be thrown at a higher speed. Some of them are meant to be thrown at a lower speed. And all your discs are happy, especially when you're throwing them. So they might only look sad, but when you throw them, they're very happy.
Well, they just seem lonely because I only have the three of them.
Right. That's all right. And you can go out and play a one disc round, which is usually done with a mid-range or a putter. Those slower discs really help you clean up your form. So that's the best thing to start with as a beginner.
So less would be more for beginners like me. I don't need to have I'll see some folks out playing and they'll have like this great big carrying case with many, many discs. I don't need that yet.
No, not yet. The best thing to start with is a mid-range or even a putter, something that's very blunt on the edge. You can pick those up for anywhere from $8 to $12. And you want to practice that straight form of throwing a disc. A good way to learn it is just to throw back and forth between friends, because you're not going to hurt your fingers with those blunter, slower flying discs. You build up rhythm. You don't have much time in between shots when you're playing catch. And you build up a better rhythm and confidence of letting go of the disc.
Yeah, and learn how to throw a disc that'll fly straight and that sort of thing.
Yes.
Yeah, and that brings me to the question, how does one learn? You've talked about throwing with friends, but what if you're oh, I'm not going to say I'm this person, but what if you're an uncoordinated disc thrower and things go off to the right or the left? Are there instructors, or how does one learn more about the correct form?
There are a lot of good instructors around. There are some of them out of Coeur d'Alene and Spokane. There's a lot of great help online. All you need to do is get on YouTube and type in disc golf instruction, and there's endless amounts in this day and age, whereas 10 years ago, there was a very limited amount. There are professionals out there who will do a Zoom lesson with you, like Scott Stokely, and then he'll do a follow-up with that. And he teaches people not only to learn how to play, but he takes experienced players and he takes them to the next level.
That's good to know. That's really good to know. As with any sport, if you want to get serious about it, lessons are often required.
Yes. Yep.
They really are. Well, why don't we talk about courses in the area? And we're going to learn about your course, but we'll finish with that. Let's talk about area courses, and then we'll talk about the one that you've developed.
Okay, so the first courses outside of this area when I moved here that I heard about was the Farragut courses. So there's a myriad of courses down there, from Kids Course up to the Big Bomber. Cutthroat, but the best courses down there, in my opinion, are the ones in the middle of the road. You've got North Star, you've got Recreator, and you've got AWOL that are excellent courses. I think it's a $5 or $7 fee per card load.
Yeah, it's pretty darn affordable. You can go to the park and then just go ahead and play.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then in this area, there's Baldfoot. Baldfoot was originally developed by Rick Leader. He worked with Steve Holt with the Eureka Institute, got permission to go in there, and he gave me a buzz, and he organized a bunch of people, and I went in there with my tractor and did a lot of tractor work, mowing down some fairways, and other people had chainsaw skills and did a lot of chainsaw work, like Steve Mix, and we ganged up on it, and Rick designed the course, and we all went to work on it and developed something we could all play on.
So it was more or less a volunteer effort to get that course put together.
100%.
Wow, that's great. I've played the course, and I love that course. It's hilly, and you go down along the creek, and it's just really kind of a fun experience over there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a nice piece of land, and I think that pieces of land like that really lend itself for disc golf because it's got a variety of terrain that you can play with, both ups and downs, and it's very aesthetically beautiful.
Right, and there are a couple more courses.
There's a little kids course right next door that is has been coined Littlefoot, and that's just a kind of a pitch and putt 9-hole course. Then there's a course out in Clark Fork called Wampus Park. I'm not sure who developed that, but that's a fun throw. It's got 9 tee pads, but 18 pins. So you play your first way around the course playing to the blue baskets. And then your second time around, you play to the yellow pins. So it gives you a variety of shots. It is on a ball golf course, but it's better suited for disc golf.
Nice. So that's one I haven't been to. I'll have to try and get out and check it out. You said there were survey stakes, so I better get out there soon.
I hope they weren't survey stakes, because that means it might follow the storyline of disc golf, which is a course gets built and then kind of disappears over time.
Let's talk about your course. How long has it been around? And its name is Caliber Disc Golf.
The name is called Caliber Disc Golf.
All right. Yes. And where's it located?
So it's located out 95. It is located at the end of Shepherd's Lane off Colburn Culver. At the very end of Shepherd's, you take a right, and we're just up that road, just 400 or 500 feet.
Okay. And how many holes is your course?
It is a full 18-hole championship-style layout, with par fours and fives, much like you would see on a traditional golf course.
Okay, so it's full-on, a full-size disc golf.
For a long time, disc golf has been mainly par threes on the holes, and it lends itself well if you have a limited amount of space, but to truly get that concept of golf and get that variety, it's best to have par fours and par fives, because then you don't have to, you know, some people say, oh, this is a 650-foot hole. It's like, it's all right. It's a par four. You don't have to bite it all off in one swing. So you can play to your strong suit. One of my favorite golf course designers is Pete Dye. And his one of his mottos was make them think in the box, give them options. So split fairways, options to play to your strong suit, whether you throw forehand or backhand, not just one way to the pin.
Sure. So you've put a lot of thought into the design of the course.
I did, but then again, it kind of laid itself out in front of me. I looked at the design of the course more from an aspect of creating a healthy forest. And the philosophy was, if I go through and clean up the forest and try to keep the diversity, showcase the beautiful stands of trees, take out some of the disease and rotten stuff, then it will most likely have a natural layout that lends itself for disc golf. So I more look at it as go in and create a healthy forest, and the benefit is you can throw a frisbee through it.
Yeah, sort of a holistic approach to doing this. We've got to back up a little bit and talk about what incentivized you, or what was the motivation to create your own course?
Well, one of the storylines of disc golf is that a bunch of people get together and build a course, and the land is sometimes lease, but most of the time it's an owner or a city or borough that says, go ahead and use this land. People will develop a course, and then over time there's a better use for that land. And because the disc golfers don't have a lot of stake in the game, that land gets taken away and the disc golfers have to go on down the road and find something else.
Yeah.
And so I figured, you know, the best way to create something in my view that's long lasting and you can really take to the nth degree and put your heart and soul into it would be on private property. So in late 2016, my wife and I were looking to get away from the south end of Colburn Culver, where I had developed a small disc golf course in the backyard. It was 5 or 6 acres. We stumbled across a piece of land at the end of Shepherd's Lane. And at first look at it, I knew it could be a disc golf course, but until you really sink your teeth into it and start to work on it, you don't realize what's really there. So the more I started cutting away holes, I think by holes 5, 6, 7, I started to realize, wow, this really has the bones. It has all the benches and beautiful trees and everything. And it's got the room where I could turn this into something. So it was more one of those American dreams where you look at something and you go, you dream and you put it to work and then you try to bring it to market.
Yeah. And it's turning out better than you hoped.
I just kept my head down. I didn't get into disc golf for fame or fortune, because both of those are kind of an illusion. And I just kept my head down and kept working and thought, you know, if this place is only to be played by me and my buddies, that's fine. I would build it exactly the same way as it turned out today if it was just me and my group of friends playing it.
Yeah. But it might turn out to be more than that, because there was an article not too long ago that ranked it pretty highly.
Yeah, it's got a good ranking, which means people come with expectations now.
True.
So every time I hear people saying, oh, you got a great course, we're coming to play it, I feel like I have to go work harder to make it even better.
Yeah.
The amount of work I did up in Alaska and tourism, you always have to kind of under-promise and overproduce, and I think that's the same in disc golf.
I think that's true in a lot of areas, but let's move on to talk about the difference in developing a disc golf course versus a ball golf course, because there are some significant differences.
Absolutely. Disc golf is more footloose and fancy free. You don't have to displace the earth. You're going to take out trees. You're going to pull stumps. I've planted thousands of dollars worth of seed and some trees, but I didn't have to displace the earth in order to create the course. I tried to use the benches and the natural lay of the land, to create a disc golf course. Whereas in traditional golf, you see big earth movers come in. They literally reshape the land. They change the watershed. They plant massive trees. Although traditional golf, if you look at some of the great courses out there, and there's many, they take decades to develop to where a golfer really looks at that course and says, this course is now mature 4 decades later. Whereas a disc golf course, you get a faster result. You're not waiting for little trees to grow up into 60-foot monsters.
Yeah, makes sense. So. And there are some big difference in terms of the maintenance and care and maintenance of disc golf versus ball golf.
Yes. So in ball golf, there's definitely a lot more stuff used on the grass to keep it all pure and pristine looking. The one thing I really like about disc golf is you don't have to go in and spray the land in order to keep things beautiful. I planted a variety of grasses and vetch and different things to keep animals coming through. I planted a lot of clover because it's a nitrogen fixing plant to help the other trees out in the immediate region recover from what I did, which was go in and, you know, I probably had to take out 3,500 trees in there. Some of them were large, but a lot of them were only, you know, you could put your hands around them. They were just little trees and a lot of them were dead. But I cleaned up the understory and made it so that if there was ever a fire in the area, I don't think a fire could blow through there. I've taken up, taken a lot of that biomass out.
Yeah. What about the water requirements, for a disc golf course versus a ball golf course? Do you need to irrigate and water it a lot?
I don't water at all. I water a little bit around an area where I've got a picnic table and a barbecue grill, which anybody's welcome to use when they come there. But I just kind of let it go on its own, and it's naturally going to die out and brown out towards the end of July, and it has that normal kind of brown, dry feeling in August. And then the rains come back in September, and I plant about every other year. I'll go in and overseed in some areas that get trampled. And it's just, you know, you got to put it down and hope for the best, hope for those rains. Seeds are pretty amazing, though. They'll harbor down in the ground and stay there till the next year, maybe pop up, maybe they won't. So,
yeah, that's a pretty significant difference, though, not to have to water and mow. And, well, we've got to mow a little, I'm sure, but not maintain to the degree that you would a ball golf course.
Yes. A lot less maintenance. I do mow on average throughout the year about every 10 days. Coming up here in May and June, I'll be mowing every 6 to 8 days. And then you get into July and it's every 10 to 12. And you know, you mow it once in August and then you're not going to touch it again until October. So mowing, I can mow the whole course with 8 gallons of fuel.
That's pretty significant difference,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, it's a big difference. It's pretty low impact.
Yeah.
The biggest impact out there that you have to work backwards from is the soil compaction from people walking.
Yeah.
So around the pins, I'll put mulch to decrease that soil compaction. Around the tee boxes, I'll also put mulch to decrease the soil compaction and keep the dirt from getting up on the tee boxes.
Makes sense, but not really close to the work that goes into maintaining a ball golf course.
Yeah, not nearly.
That sounds great to me. Well, I don't want to start a major controversy in the ball golf and disc golf and maybe the pickleball and tennis world, but I've been wanting to have this discussion during the interview, and it's about sort of old-time sports and then new developments on sports that are similar. And I want to make a parallel comparison between ball golf and disc golf and tennis and pickleball, because you've talked about this. I'm a little more of a pickleball player, but I've played some disc golf, and of course you're a devoted disc golf player, but there seems to me that there could be some attitude brought from ball golf to disc golf, that maybe one is the better or more just more elevated sport. And we sometimes get a little of that between tennis and pickleball. Where do you stand?
I like them both. I see that traditional golf has its unique challenges that you can't get out of disc golf, and disc golf has its own unique challenges that traditional golf will never give you. One of them is the green area in disc golf is not quite as intricate and elaborate as a ball golf green. So there's a lot of detail and planning that goes around a green, also a ton of money and work that goes around a ball golf green to make it what it is. It's very dynamic. So disc golf greens aren't as intricate as a ball golf. There's a lot of converts who've come over to disc golf from ball golf, not thinking that they were really going to like it, but it's the same mentality where you have a risk reward. You have to stay inside your own head. You have to practice your shot and then get up and not think about mechanics, but just throw. So you do field work, you play catch with a friend, or in traditional golf, you can go to the range and hit 100 or 200 balls and work on your form. In disc golf, it's called field work. So you take your bag or you take your pile of discs to a local field and you work on your mechanics so that when you get up and you throw in disc golf, you don't think mechanics, you just think, I'm going to throw it there.
Yeah.
And it's the same in traditional golf. So purists, traditional golfers convert very easily because they can take that knowledge and strategy and bring it directly over to disc golf, learn the form, and go out and have a lot of fun.
Yeah, so really there are some similarities and different strokes for different folks. We'll say if you're wanting to throw a disc, you're going to try out the disc golf. And if you're devoted to ball golf, you'll continue with that maybe. Yeah. But both are great sports. We'll say the same of tennis and pickleball. There are discussions and maybe some competition about which is more fun or which has more provenance, et cetera. But really both are great sports. So we'll leave it at that.
Yes.
All right. Well, then I'm going on to the next controversial question for you, Paul. I hope you can handle it. This is about the attire of disc golf versus some of our other sports. I've played a number of times, and I have to say, it seems pretty casual, and there is beer drinking.
It's very casual, and there's some beer drinking going on the course. You'll see some tall, flashy socks. You'll see some funny hats. Pretty much anything goes on a disc golf course because, you know, a lot of us are just, from the land of misfits, and maybe we didn't fit in a lot of other sports. So you've got a lot of different folks who play disc golf and they're not going to hold back, and they just kind of let it all out when they're on the course. They might have a shirt on, they might not. On the professional level of disc golf, they're definitely cleaning it up, collared shirts. A lot of these top pros are being sponsored, being paid $1 million a year just to sign a contract and throw certain discs is becoming more popular, both on the male and female side of things. So it depends on what level you're at, but at your general park, it's kind of anything goes. There are slowly becoming some specific shoes to disc golf, which is a good thing because you want to have something fairly sturdy where you're not going to roll your ankle over.
Yeah, not a flip-flop, you're saying.
People do play in flip-flops, and there are people who play in bare feet. You definitely have to have strong feet. I almost think bare feet might be good because it lets your foot spin. When you come in to throw the disc, you're going to land on your toe and then come down to your heel and pivot off your heel and spin. So you need a shoe that has a coefficient of friction that lets you spin. So
bare feet might work.
It might really work because you have a good feel of the ground. Yeah. The other thing that has come about is getting away from concrete tee pads, although they're very durable and they last for a long time, and going to AstroTurf. And that's what I did on Caliber because it's easier on your feet. It's easier on your knees. I'm 55 years old. I'm not getting any younger. And the concrete boxes, the more you play, they can start pounding. They can pound on your feet and knees, and over time you start feeling it.
Boy, I get it. Concrete's tough to be on. Yeah, hard on the back, hard on the feet. Well, it's a sport that's growing up, isn't it? It's it has a pro side. People are working on their attire. There's equipment being developed more and more, that sort of thing. Well, I'd like to circle back to benefits of disc golf. We talked about one, the environmental benefits. It's sort of a lower impact, not a big water user. You're not putting as much time and energy into mowing, that kind of thing. But there are other benefits. Is it a year-round? Can we play disc golf year-round?
Disc golf is definitely played year-round in colder climates, provided there's not that much snow. Although there is a crew over at Baldfoot that plays throughout the winter on Saturdays at 1 o'clock. They're diehards. Wow. They'll shovel the boxes.
Oh, wow.
They'll salt the boxes.
And tromp through snow.
They are true troopers.
Wow.
Down at Farragut, those holes can be a little spread out and sometimes a little longer, so you don't have as dedicated of a crew of shoveling down there, but you'll still find those boxes to be shoveled and salted occasionally throughout the winter. A course like mine, it's too hilly and the snow's too deep. We're right in line with Schweitzer, so we still have upwards of a foot of snow on better than half the course right now. It's melting out very quickly, but you're in waist-deep snow out at my place.
So. Yeah, snowshoes only. That might be a little rough. But yeah. Other parts of the country where we don't get quite as much snow, I'm sure it would be year-round sport.
Absolutely. People will go out there and wear gloves and boots and get cold. The good thing about it is you're outside, you're exercising. It's a healthy thing. You're not in a poisoned environment. And during COVID, disc golf, some people say it's doubled.
Well, that brings me to an interesting point, because my husband, Daniel, pointed out a Wall Street Journal article he saw from March of this year that mentioned two things, that the sport had really almost doubled the number of participants, and unfortunately that they were having a hard time manufacturing enough discs for all the people learning. I understand the discs have been in a bit of a shortage during COVID.
Yes, there's definitely a bit of a shortage. Not only did manufacturers run into a staffing issue, but then you have more and more people buying discs. And then you have your maybe last 5-year advent of people hoarding discs and collecting discs. And there's some people in our community who are sitting on a couple thousand discs because, well, they're called plastic addicts. And I'm not a plastic addict, but I've got a couple hundred for myself. But I more cycle through them. So in disc golf, different than traditional golf, you can go to the range and hit balls and ball golf. In disc golf, if you throw a certain driver, it's good to own two or three. That way, when you go do your field work, you've got the same disc or relatively the same disc that you can practice with. And then you can take the one you like for that day, or say you're going to go play in more of a windy environment. You can grab your more stable ones and put them in the bag. So people have, if you carry 20 discs in your bag like me, I've got 3 or 4 backups for each one. So I've probably got 70 discs that are in my repertoire that I'll cycle in and out of over time. But then they last a long time and you get to really know those discs. So that's why you see people in the bushes and in the trees looking for discs for so long, because it's really hard to go out there and just replace it.
Yeah, makes sense. And I can understand that as your skill improves and you're getting more discs, of course, and there are more players and more players getting better, so there's a greater demand for more discs.
Absolutely.
Makes sense. Hey, what about dogs? Are they generally allowed on disc golf courses?
Dogs are mostly allowed on disc golf courses. Down at Farragut, I think they want you to have your dog on a leash. I know at Baldfoot, they would like you to have your dog on a leash. All depends on the dog. The one downside is they're going to go to the bathroom out there, and sometimes your disc will wind up in it, and that's always a bummer. Out at my place, I do not allow dogs for a couple reasons. One is you never know what dog is going to come out, and if there's kids on the course, I don't want any issues with dogs biting some of the kids or going over to the neighbor's house. And then our neighbors have dogs, so
Yeah, you know, dogs are kind of a tough issue in some areas.
Dogs and disc golf really go together. Out at my place, if someone brings a dog, then all the other dogs are going to come over. And there's usually not a tussle, but then there's this pee and poop war. And then they're marking their spots, and it becomes this little war that goes on.
Understandable. Plus, you're promoting wildlife, so dogs can sometimes be a negative for
chase
certain
off the
wildlife.
Deer and the other critters.
What about costs of disc golf compared to other sports? It seems pretty reasonable, I think.
Disc golf's very easy to get into. You can start with a $8 to $12 putter or mid-range. It doesn't have to be one of the higher end plastics. You can pick that up from Johnny Eastow over at Run It Disc Golf on Baldy Mountain Road. They also have some at Big Five. There's some shops down in Spokane and Coeur d'Alene, Post Falls, that you can go to. Playing the courses are fairly cheap. Baldfoot asks for a $1 donation. Now, when I was on the board at Baldfoot, we would sit back and watch groups come in, and we realized that only one out of three people actually put a dollar in. And they might think, well, I've put $10 in this year. Isn't that enough? But really, to play for a dollar is a really good deal. It pales in comparison to what it takes to build a course.
Yes, I'm going to make a pitch to all you disc golf people. Annie up. That is so reasonable. If it's $1, oh my gosh, let's pay up and try and keep it nice out there.
Yeah.
Right. Some of you are volunteers, and in your case, you're a private proprietor, and there are costs to operating and keeping it nice, and that's what makes it worth it, what makes it nice. So, folks, put the money in the self-pay box.
So the costs out at Caliber. To play one round is $15, and then I sell a 10-round pass, which never expires, and that's $95. So, you know, it takes you 3 hours to get through a round. It costs you almost $10. It's $3 an hour, and for the quality of golf that you'll experience, most find it's very worth it. The passes never expire, and, you know, it helps me keep the lights on. I pay the taxes. I've got insurance. There's a lot of costs that I'm not able to defer or get supplemented.
Yeah, it makes total sense if you're running your own course like that. Now, Farragut, a place like Farragut, if the park is open, the course is open, Mount Baldy or Baldfoot, you just come out and, you know, line up if people are waiting. How does it work for you, a more private situation? Can anyone just show up at any time?
Yeah, we're always open to walk-ons, although I'd prefer it if you would call or text, or you can get on Facebook and book a tee time. I run tee times every 15 minutes, although I can get out just a little bit better than four groups an hour, especially your Saturday, Sunday mornings. I might have 2.5 hours completely booked. If you do pop out, you know, there's a good chance somebody else isn't going to be coming, or there's a space in there, we can still get you out. But generally, it's a, you know, make a tee time or just come out and take your chances.
Yeah, nice to plan, though, if you know you're coming. And then, of course, you know, you get an opportunity to play and not have to wait around.
There's courses out of Seattle and Portland that if you don't get out there by 8 o'clock in the morning in the summer, you'll be 20th in line to tee off.
So that would be a long wait.
That's where tee times come in handy. You know, if you're going to tee off at 10 o'clock, you're best to pull in at 20 till 10, do some putting, practice with a friend, playing catch out in the lot or over on another piece of property I've got. And then you're ready to tee off at your time. And then that way things don't get backed up and things are more predictable.
Yeah, and really enjoy your time out at your place. Well, as we start to come to a close here, I'd like to ask you, how would you recommend someone who's new or relatively new to the sport get themselves going? Give us a little plan for how a new disc golf player might want to get going.
I think it's as easy as just going over to Run It Disc Golf over on Baldy Mountain Road at Johnny Eastow's shop and tell him, hey, I'm looking to start disc golf. How do I get into this? He'll set you up with a basic disc. And most people on the disc golf course are very willing to help you out. So you can just show up at Baldfoot, watch how people throw. You can watch a couple YouTubes and go out there and just wing it, literally. You can start over on the kids' course where you've got baskets that are an easy throw away. You're not going to lose your discs over there. It's a pretty easy thing to get into, whereas traditional golf, it's a much steeper learning curve. Disc golf is fairly cheap and easy to get into. You don't want to go out and buy a driver if you're a beginner. You don't need the high-tech plastics and the $30 discs. You don't need a bag with 30 discs in it or 20. It's kind of like traditional golf. You want to start with a 7-iron and just hit some balls easy. And you want to do the same thing in disc golf, which is grab a blunt nose disc and play catch with a friend.
Yeah.
Keeps you loose and keeps you in the game.
Well, you make it sound so much fun too, and easy, and not to get too anxious or excited. Just get out and try it out, see if you like it, and just basically go from there.
Yep, absolutely.
I like that. I like that philosophy. Well, Paul Stiller, do you have anything you'd like to add? We're coming to an end of our really interesting interview about disc golf.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about Baldfoot, and I got to mention some names here because that is a core group of guys who got that all together from the beginning. Started with Rick Leader getting permission through the Eureka Institute and Steve Holt. And then a gang of folks got in there. There's Steve Mix, Brandon, Dan, Tim Hutto, Mike Brown. Caleb was on the excavator. And then board members in the past and present consist of Christian, Mike Givens, Josh DeLucci, Carl Kleinkoff. You've got Danny Peter. You've got Charlie Walker. John Gaddis is a board member right now and does a ton of work. You got Maddie Jablonski, who's been in there swinging the bat, who's no longer a board member now. And then last but not least, couple guys, Kendall Poole was president for a while and did a tremendous amount of work in there. And now you've got Eric Nelson, who Eric and John Gaddis are two of the main players in there right now on the board. And you know, the story of disc golf and Baldfoot isn't over. It can be possibly coming on some perilous times, whether that course stays established as Baldfoot or changes and turns into something else. They have hopes to turn it into a multi-use facility and somehow incorporate it in with the master plan of Sandpoint. It would be a tragedy if it was lost. I know there's hundreds and hundreds of people who play Baldfoot. There's a lot of people who come from different parts of Pacific Northwest to play my course, or just come up from Spokane and Coeur d'Alene to play Baldfoot because it's a good course and it's inexpensive. And all those people who come into the county, they buy fuel. They might buy some beer.
I would.
They go out and eat. So they bring money into the county. It plays well into the four-season recreational sports where four-season recreational, you know, resort where people come to town, they drop money in your town, and they drive away. And takes a variety of that to support people here in the summer, too.
Yeah, and leave with a positive experience in Sandpoint area. And I'll point this out. One, it is kind of a shoulder season sport. You can play it in the spring and the fall when there's not that much other stuff going on.
Yeah.
Which I like about it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And yeah, could be perilous times for that course, as you've discussed earlier, that courses come and go because they sometimes get moved along for other purposes. So fingers crossed that Baldfoot can remain with us.
Yeah. Some of the core members right now are going to make a push to do a private drive and raise some money and be able to take it over themselves and at least give back to the city if they want to jump on it and keep it as their own. As their own course. It might have to go pay to play in the future, much like your local public swimming pool, although we don't have one in this town, but most towns have a $3 to $5, maybe $8. You know, you're going to go swimming at the pool, you know, pay a little bit, and that would help keep things together.
Right. I think the world, the area, the region understands that recreation isn't free. If you want to be able to enjoy recreation, we've got to be willing to pay for it. Here in
Idaho. A
little
bit, possibly. Yeah,
not necessarily a ton, but a little. Well, I'm going to wrap up this wonderful interview. Paul Stiller, huge proponent for disc golf in the area. I want to thank you for joining us. You're here talking about everything disc golf and telling us about your course out at Caliber Disc Golf, too. I want to thank you for joining us today. And I'll have you finish up by giving us contact info if folks want to get out and go golfing at your place.
Sure. We will be opening on April 20th of just in a couple weeks, coming up pretty quick here. You can call me directly at 208-920-0541, or you can text me to request a tee time or just ask questions. I also have a Facebook page that is Caliber Disc Golf, and there will be a book now link at the top, and you can get on there and book a time. And those run every 15 minutes. We're open 7 days a week, dawn to dusk. We're located at 83 Caliber Drive at the end of Shepherd's Lane off Colburn Culver on the north end of the Selly Valley.
Well, very good. This has been your KRFY morning show for Tuesday, and we're talking about all things disc golf, and we've really learned a lot. Thank you, Paul, and I hope the listeners have enjoyed this interview.
Thank you very much, Julie.